Today is September 23rd, 2015, and this is episode number 325 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, and I'm living in my own private Idaho. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
Are the rents higher because it's a private Idaho?
Yes, but we use our own currency, so it's all good.
Excellent. I'm glad there was a way to balance that out.
Now, this is what happens when I start thinking about what title I'm going to use when you say this is episode number XXX.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize I don't have a title.
Well, the great thing is at least you're planning ahead. It might be by only a few syllables, but you're planning ahead. And I'm really proud of you for doing that.
Oh, goodness gracious. What does that say about me? If that's making you proud of me, what does that actually say? That says nothing good.
No, it's good because
I'm going to go back to my first love, directing films.
All right. The fact that I was proud of you means I'm not disappointed in you. So anyhow, I think that that with your vision, the films that you direct are going to be amazing.
It's a good thing we don't record the pre-show.
Boy, howdy.
Have I got an idea?
But boss, I'm not that flexible.
Right. So, it's been busy in the Apple world.
Yeah. Yes, it has. Yeah.
It's been busy in the Apple world. Let's actually talk about the thing that we said we were going to talk about and then forgot that we said that we were going to talk about it and then put other things on the list, and then we'll see where we go from there. Let's talk about Boblets.
All right.
Right? Didn't we say we were going to talk about that?
Maybe.
Yeah, I think we did.
But so mixed anyway. In with all the other pre-show stuff that was happening.
Yeah, you had to wipe your mind. I get it.
Yeah.
So former GM Vice Chairman Boblets.
Yep. He says that Apple Car is a money pit.
It'll never work. No, so he was being interviewed on CNBC, and he was clearly picked to be interviewed on CNBC because he was going to say a bunch of nervous Nelly stuck in the...
He was going to say exactly what they wanted, which was negative towards Apple Car.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me read one of his early quotes. He said, "If I were a shareholder, I'd be very upset. They are currently engaged in a very high margin business. The automobile business, at best, is a very low margin business. You can't show me one company in the world that to date has made a nickel on electric cars. They're generally money losers. The only reason that everyone is producing them is because they are necessary to meet European fuel economy regulations and U.S. fuel economy regulations. There's absolutely no reason to assume that Apple is going to be financially successful in the electric car business."
And this probably says a lot about me, because the first thing that comes to mind was where he said, "If I were a shareholder," that it should have been followed by "tweedle deedle deedle tweedle deedle deedle dum." Anyhow, it sure sounds a lot like the rhetoric we heard when the iPhone was coming out.
Well, that's just the thing, is it's the rhetoric that we get whenever Apple is going to do something, and it is the exact same rhetoric about the iPhone. The cell phone market is a low margin business. Nobody makes any money. Apple has no expertise.
Right. How can anyone expect a computer maker to just walk into this market and be successful?
Right. What do they think they know? You know, or I mean, what do they know about cell phones? That was one of the things we often heard. And, you know, of course, we all know how that worked out. And we have also learned a lot about how Apple only enters markets it thinks it can disrupt, that it thinks it can change. And those markets are usually established markets that have essentially fallen into a rut.
Sure. And they meaning the people that are currently dominant in these markets, they're okay with the rut they're in because it's been working for them. And disruption means that they have to change what they're doing.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes a disruption can be manufacturing. Sometimes it can be a product idea. It can be a different way of doing things. It can be a different, you know, process for making stuff. There's lots of different ways to disrupt a market. Apple's way of disrupting markets has been to bring a just completely new paradigms for the way devices should work. I mean, you know, we all take for granted today the idea that our phones don't have a physical keyboard. But I mean, do you remember all the screaming about that?
Oh yeah, there's no way this will ever succeed. It doesn't have a keyboard. But then again, I remember when the iMac came out. There's no way this could succeed. It doesn't even have a floppy drive.
Yeah, no floppy drive, no ADB, no SCSI, no whatever. This thing is going to be a flop. You know, and Apple has constantly changed the rules when it enters the market, or in the case of the Mac, when it re-entered the market. Apple changes the rules. I mean, Apple went from competing on specs and price, which is something Apple didn't do well because it wasn't in it wasn't in the commodity. Apple did not do well at the commodity end of that market.
No, they didn't. It was a fight that they should not have engaged.
Right. And Steve Jobs changed those rules with the iMac, in addition, of course, to jettisoning legacy hardware, legacy technologies that were near the end of their lives, if not at the end or past the end of their lives. Mm-hmm. Apple began competing on lifestyle, fashion, ergonomics, style.
Apple went after the points that matter to the average person. They went for the emotional sell as opposed to numbers.
Right. And it was hugely successful.
Yeah, and Apple still does that. I mean, how many people know what processor is in their iPhone or how much RAM it has?
Yeah, not many, that's for sure.
Most people don't care.
And most people don't care because it doesn't really matter. It matters to nerds and geeks.
Right, and in many cases, more so than it needs to.
Well, it matters from the standpoint, and we're nerds and geeks, by the way. We're talking about our own people here. It matters from the standpoint of caring about it, whether outside of necessarily having a need to care about it.
Right.
I mean, cell phones are just plenty fast these days.
They are, and yet they continue to get faster. But for the tasks most people are doing, it doesn't matter at all.
Moving on to the iPod, Apple made a music player, entered that market, and the way it did so, the way it disrupted that market was to use a brand new tiny hard drive technology, mm-hmm. and a completely innovative user interface with a scroll wheel.
And it was really cool.
And it was cool, but it wasn't the same. Apple entered that market because it was something that Apple could disrupt. But it didn't disrupt it in the same way that it disrupted the computer market.
True.
And when it came out with the iTunes Store, Apple disrupted music sales by getting the labels to allow it to sell singles.
That was a huge thing.
It was a huge thing. And of course, the interface for the iTunes Store was also, like, hands down, better than everything else that was out there, most of which was, actually all of which was web-based. It was slow, clunky, ugly.
Yeah, that's true. And then Apple gives us this slick-looking native application.
It still had some web calls, but it is
It did, but the application looked nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The application part was the native bit. The content was being pulled.
Right.
So it was, you know, hybrid model that worked really, really well. And Apple revolutionized that market. For tablets, a market which everybody knew was a failed market and that no one could do anything with, Apple simply gave us an iPod Super Touch.
As you coined.
Yeah. And brought with it a different way of selling books, which worked fabulously until the U.S. government shut it down. And Apple still actually has market share, but...
But not what they could.
Not what they could. Yeah, definitely not what they could have. And, you know, Apple went... For e-books, Apple went from competing on price again to competing on experience. So same thing it did with the iMac. And with all that in mind, it's pretty safe to assume that if Apple's going to do a car, it has something disruptive it thinks it can do. Apple's not making a car to make a car. Apple is not making a car because it has too much money.
I agree. Apple is not going to enter into markets where they can't disrupt.
And if Apple believes it can disrupt the car market, it has Apple's track history says it has a basis for thinking that.
Yes. And so people that are executives or experts in the car manufacturing field would probably be better served to spend their time focusing on what is it that they can do to compete with whatever Apple may have in store, which is hard when you don't know what it really is, as opposed to just spouting rhetoric and posturing.
The stuff that we've gotten from the naysayers in the auto industry has essentially been, there's no way Apple can do this better than us. And that's their mistake. What they should be asking is, oh no, what does Apple know that we don't?
Right. What is Apple going to be able to do different or differently? Yeah. They should be very worried. And I'm assuming that on some level they are, even though they're not showing that publicly.
Some of them. Well, yeah. I mean, we did, I ran a piece about how Apple and Google were both the talk of the Frankfurt Motor Show, dominating conversation, even though neither one of them were there. And, neither one of them actually has a car on the market.
And that should be something that greatly concerns current car makers.
Well, it was the current car makers that were doing the talking. So, I mean, not all car industry execs are taking the Bob Lutz approach.
Which is good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of the there have been several execs that have actually come out and said things like the Renault chairman said something to the effect of Apple entering the electric car market will be good for us because it'll raise consumer awareness. I think the Fiat guy said something along the lines of Apple will be a worthy competitor, but don't write off legacy car makers yet. He didn't put it that way, but that was the essence of what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there have been various, the Daimler Chrysler chairman said something along the lines of, we wouldn't see Apple as a competitor, which is going to be an LOL statement eventually.
Yes.
But there have been some folks that have actually embraced it. And the thing is, well, there was something specific that Bob Lutz said that just really, really screamed at me. Mm-hmm. He said he was asked if by the CNBC hosts if Apple's expertise in batteries and consumer devices would allow the company to bring a different approach to an electric car. And he's not like a really highly animated guy, but he came close to being highly animated, just, you know, itching to jump at this. And he said, no. First of all, Apple has no expertise in batteries. They don't make batteries. The specialized electrochemical companies make batteries, and Apple's going to buy batteries like everybody else. And when it comes to actually making cars, there's no reason to assume that Apple, with no experience, will suddenly do a better job than General Motors, Ford, Volkswagen, Toyota, or whomever. I think this is going to be a gigantic money pit. And this is like the ultimate example to me of inside the box thinking. To be fair, also coupled with ignorance of how Apple does stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because Apple may not have expertise in making batteries, but Apple is probably the world's leading expert in power management and implementing batteries, deploying batteries.
And they also hired away key employees from a company called ABC.
123, right?
Yeah, ABC 123.
Systems, right? ABC 123 systems, or was it 123 systems?
No, it's ABC, so it must be ABC 123 systems. Anyhow, so they had several employees that were working on some serious new, innovative, and potentially revolutionary battery technology, and Apple hired all those people away.
Yeah, so actually, Apple literally has some expertise in batteries. Directly refuting Mr. Lutz's comment.
Mm-hmm.
But what Mr. Lutz is not understanding is, in his mind, car makers, they make a car, they make a frame, they make a body, they make a drivetrain, they make some kind of power station, you know, be it an engine or an electric motor, and then they buy batteries and they put them in the batteries, they call it an electric car, and then, you know,
And away they go.
But that's not what Apple does. Because Apple controls the hardware and the software, the company is able to do things that no other company in the consumer electronics space, in the computer space, can do when it comes to efficiently using power. And these are things that translate directly to making a car.
Right. And Apple's in a unique position compared to the old school car makers, because they don't have an infrastructure that they have to work within. They get to start all of this from scratch.
Well, right. And there's definitely pluses and minuses to that. I mean, you know, Apple's doubters on this are correct that Apple doesn't have any experience in making a car, and that it's a different manufacturing concept and experience and process than making consumer devices. It's also a different regulatory field. I mean, it's not like this is just a shoo-in for Apple to do well at this.
That's true.
I'm by no means arguing that. I'm just saying that Apple has a lot of stuff that it can bring to bear. And when people like Bob Lutz are saying that Apple has no expertise in batteries, you can kind of dismiss everything he has to say, because that's factually wrong.
Right. And if he has a fact that, or that type of a fact wrong, something that's easily refutable and easy to check, then how many of the other points that he's rattling off are factually wrong as well?
Yeah, it's just, when you're an expert in your field, and Bob Lutz is an expert in his field, when you're an expert in your field and you know everything there is to know about that field, you are no longer at a point where you can think differently about it. This is true with almost everything.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. He's stuck in his frame of mind, and that comes from the years of experience that he has in that field.
Yeah, which is understandable. It's when you know everything there is to know, it's almost impossible to see those things in a new light. And people coming in from the outside who don't know can often see amazing things, you know, a different way to do things. I'm not saying that ignorance somehow gives Apple an edge here. That's not the case. What I am saying, though, is that Apple has expertise that it can bring to bear in a new market that will allow Apple, could allow, should allow, history says it will allow Apple to find new ways of doing things that give it a leg up and will allow the company to make a disruptive product.
Right. And yes. And the key thing there is you said history has shown.
Yeah.
And that's true. If not, we wouldn't have our iPhones and iPads today.
Right. Now, John Welch, whom I admire greatly.
Mm-hmm. John is an awesome guy.
Yeah, he's an excellent writer. He's super smart. He basically said that he called me an idiot. No, he didn't. He said that none of this is... He goes on... He basically sort of supports what Mr. Lutz has to say and then ends with... this is in a comment on our article, my article. He said, none of this is to say that that Apple can't do well in this market, but dismissing Lutz's points is kind of dumb. I would argue that the foundation of my dismissal, which is that Mr. Lutz is thinking inside the box and is factually wrong on some points, is not dumb. I think I don't know. I stand by my piece, that's for sure.
And I think you have some good logic in your piece. And if nothing else, you have Apple's historic record where they have been able to step into markets where they otherwise don't have a great deal of experience and produce a product that does well and disrupts the market.
Yes. Now, it's still possible that Apple is going to pull this project.
Oh, sure. They can pull any project. It's if they decide that it's going to be cost prohibitive, then the whole car project can just die. Just like that.
Just like that. And the Wall Street Journal reported late last week, or was that Monday? Might have been Monday. Reported that Apple has moved Project Titan, which is the name of this car project, to a committed status. In other words, Apple is committed to doing it. Doesn't mean that Apple will do it, but Apple's committed to doing it. Does it make sense?
Yeah, it's also kind of funny.
It's all about nomenclature and attitude. I mean, the reality. So you know what Apple does is they say no to most products and to most product ideas. But once a project gets to a certain stage of development, it almost always comes to market. That's Apple's sort of like the complete mirror image of, like, you know, all of its competitors and all of the markets that it competes in.
Which is kind of funny.
Yeah. At least I think so. And I would have, if you had asked me, is Apple anywhere near the point where this project is almost definitely going to come to market? I would have said no. And my gut feeling is that development is still well shy of that stage. But It seems like Apple's top executives are committed to are committed to making it work. They seem to think that they have a way of doing this that's going to make sense.
Well, Apple recently had a meeting with State of California about was it regulations for
two sets of meetings. One was with Gomentum Station. And Gomentum Station is a former military base.
Right.
5,000 acres. It's got, I think, 20 miles of roads or something to that effect. It's got a lot of miles of roads.
Yeah, it's a secure location where you can test cars.
Right. And it's owned by a public agency, but it's a private facility. So, which means that it's sort of this
mishmash.
That'll work too. It's a private facility. I can't just go on to Gomentum Station and start, you know, asking questions and looking and seeing what companies can do. Companies can bring their and it is specifically designed for autonomous vehicle testing. So companies can buy time at this place and go work on their stuff in private. But because it's owned by a public agency, a lot of documents are subject to various Freedom of Information Act requests. Mm-hmm. And so we know that Apple met with them, and Gomentum Station merely said that Apple was, you know, basically interested in what they have to offer. Mm-hmm. And then Apple independently met with the California Department of Motor Vehicles to talk about the regulatory framework for testing autonomous vehicles on the open roads, which is what Google is doing now.
Okay. So that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. It is, but at the same time, the other thing that the Wall Street Journal said is that Apple's moved its timeline up to 2019 instead of 2020. That was the time frame that previous leaks had suggested, mm-hmm. including a story that I think was a controlled leak to the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. This one, I didn't get the impression was controlled. Kind of hard to put my finger on why.
You've been around in this industry long enough that if your gen instincts are telling you that, it's probably right.
Thank you. So anyway, the story said that the Apple's moved the time frame up to 2019 and that the first vehicle that Apple would enter the market with would not be autonomous.
Which seems reasonable. I mean, if you're jumping into the market and it's happening in 2019, that means that Apple has had, in the grand scheme of things, a relatively short amount of time to create their car. That tells me not autonomous.
Yeah, well, so we know that Apple's been working on this for at least a year. So that would be like a five-year development time would be insanely fast for a completely new car from an established car maker. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Apple does have a reputation for fast development times. But I don't think, I mean, and the autonomous car thing is so new. I mean, like we all know that Google has, I don't know, I think a couple of dozen, maybe even multiple dozen, maybe even a few score of autonomous cars on the road. Mm-hmm. And that they're looking to have, I think something like 200 or 300 within the next few years. But what people might not realize is that those cars are not allowed to be driverless within cities. They're only on highways. And that's because autonomous vehicles can't handle cities yet. I mean, we're still way early, way, way early in autonomous vehicles being a thing that actually works everywhere, let alone clearing regulatory hurdles. In many cases, mm-hmm. those regulations don't even exist yet.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
So right now, what's happening in California, because there's so much autonomous vehicle R&D that's being done in California, and therefore testing will be done in California, the way that California ends up regulating this particular area could end up becoming a model not only for other states, but possibly for the federal government, too.
Oh, I'm assuming that's exactly what's going to happen.
It has often happened with California. So, I mean, we're so early at this. I mean, I don't care if Apple could make and actually have an autonomous vehicle ready to go in 2019, Apple wouldn't be able to sell it.
No, they wouldn't.
So, you know, it makes a lot of sense for Apple to enter the market with an electric car that we drive. It'll probably have some autonomous features like self-parking and other things, that are already in existence.
Yeah, that makes sense. And some of those features have been around for years, so they're very well tested, and it wouldn't be in a broad sweeping way a big deal for Apple to add things in like parking and proximity sensing, those sorts of things.
Yeah, exactly. You know, detecting sudden impediments to your path, and I mean, there's all kinds of things that are already out there.
Yeah, now Apple can do what they have done so many times before and take the things that are already there, put them together in a new and compelling way, and disrupt a market.
Right. You know, the more I thought about Bob Lutz saying that Apple has no expertise in batteries, the more I thought that Apple's key here may well be, ironically, battery life. And I say ironic because we all know that when it comes to its computers and smartphones and tablets, that Apple sacrifices battery life for form.
Yes, but then Apple figures out clever ways to squeeze as much out of those batteries as it can.
Yes, I think the MacBook, Apple Insider did a piece, MacBook gets the same battery life as the 13-inch MacBook Pro with Retina display,
mm-hmm.
but it does so with a battery that is half the capacity.
Yeah.
I mean, that's astounding.
It is. Or how about just making changes in software, which is what happened with iOS 9, that increase battery life dramatically, like in some cases up to an hour a day.
Yeah, sure. And that comes to like Apple's ability to essentially shut components off for microseconds to save power, which is something that I happen to know that Apple does on both its laptops and smartphones.
Sure.
It's one of the many things that Apple does. And it's able to do that better than everybody else because it controls the hardware and the software.
Right. And that's a big deal.
That is a big deal. And so, again, going back to the ironic thing, there's a lot that Apple can do when it comes to deploying batteries, but also when it comes to power management within a car. And when you're talking about a car where you have fewer spatial constraints than compared to, say, like an iPhone,
mm-hmm.
I see the potential for Apple to be able to have significant power savings from the standpoint of how many batteries, you know, how much battery capacity is needed. Because now we're talking about, you know, every pound you save in a car translates into energy savings for propelling that car forward or backward.
Right. Yeah, that's just physics.
Right. And so if Apple can deploy batteries physically, like it does, you know, it came up, it worked with its battery partners for the MacBook, the new MacBook, to deploy asymmetric batteries.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, again, as Bob Lutz says, Apple has no expertise in batteries. And it also figured out how to use space within the MacBook case that no one's ever used before for things like battery.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Apple has no expertise in batteries.
Very innovative.
Yeah, extremely innovative. So now, if Apple can apply those same ideas to a car, it can save space and weight.
Right, which means you're going to be able to make a car go farther on a single charge than you otherwise would.
Yes. Yes, you can. And that, to me, that could be a game changer. I mean, like, there was Business Insider did chart of the day for cars. Got to find it.
Glad you had that one ready to go.
Yeah.
Of course, well, to be fair, this isn't a topic we'd planned on discussing on the show.
Well, it is. We planned and then forgot. So anyway,
all right.
Their chart was Apple has four years to change our minds about electric cars. Now, I actually disagree with that premise. Apple will need approximately a presentation to change our minds. Apple doesn't need to work 4 years to change anything. It simply needs to introduce the thing that actually did. Anyway, so right.
Well, okay. How about if it were phrased as Apple has 4 years to give us or to put together the presentation to change our minds about cars?
I would like that better. So here are the concerns that people have about cars, according to a Harris poll. Price, 67% of respondents were concerned about price. 64% were concerned about range. 58% were concerned about repair and maintenance costs. 53% about reliability. 50% performance and power, which actually is weird because electric cars usually have better performance than
combustion cars. How little the average person knows about electric cars.
and electric guitars, but that's another story altogether. 42% are concerned because it's still a new technology, whatever. 11% concerned because there's no manual transmission, whatever.
Wait, are you serious?
Yeah.
Do you know how hard it is to get a car in the United States with a manual transmission?
Well, apparently 11% of folks actually care about that. So,
well, there you go.
Range and price. We discussed before, the Apple car is not going to be cheap. This is not going to be the car for the rest of us.
No, it's not. Eventually there will be cheaper versions, but not at first.
Not at first, and there will probably never be cheap versions. There may be cheaper versions. But, you know, just like Tesla competes at the high end. Apple's going to be competing at the high end of the market too, I'm sure. But
yeah,
the range thing is the second biggest concern. So if Apple can significantly change the range of an electric car, it would be a real game changer.
Yeah, that would be a huge thing. I mean, right now, Tesla is limited to, around 250 miles a charge?
I think. I haven't looked at any recent data from them, but that at least feels truthy.
All right, we'll go with that. But whatever the number is that Tesla has for their maximum range, it's noticeably longer distance than the next competitor.
Right. So, okay, fair enough.
Yeah. So what
know is, I think the Leaf does like 300 miles, doesn't it? God, if only we had a way of looking things up. Tesla range.
I
265 miles.
Okay.
That's the Tesla Model S. So Nissan Leaf range. Bad battery. Is that a hybrid or electric only? 84-mile battery only. Oh, wow. So that is significant.
That is significant. Yeah. A lot of the cars are coming in around 100 miles.
Right. Okay. So Tesla's leading that. Yeah. I mean, a lot's going to change for all the manufacturers between now and then.
Oh, yeah. And if Apple comes in with some revolutionary new battery technology system, and they can be 265 miles on a charge...
Well, they will. I mean, four years from now, they will. I mean, but Tesla will also have beaten that by now.
Right. So whatever Tesla is doing, if Apple can squeeze out more, that'll be a really big thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it will be. So I don't have... This is only a gut feeling, but Bob Lutz saying this about Apple not having any battery technology, or any battery expertise, really, really... made me start thinking about this, and it just seems like it's something that Apple could be very competitive with.
My assumption is Apple does want to be competitive there.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. And there would be cost savings too. You know, like every bit of battery capacity you can save, it's not only a weight savings, but there's also a cost savings too. There's a lot. The iPhone, the biggest thing with the iPhone, Apple wants the iPhone to be thin and everything, you know, and it crams every bit of battery that it can. And it's, for instance, it's why Apple wanted to move from the 30-pin dock to the Lightning connector, because it took up so much less space inside. All of those things that Apple learns are things that can be applied to a car.
Right.
And it just, it scales up dramatically.
Yes. And it sure looks like Apple has been bringing in the people that have the right expertise to be able to really pull this off, which goes back to, what do you mean Apple doesn't have any experience with batteries?
Expertise. It's so weird that he would say that. It's just so factually wrong. So factually wrong. And the title of my piece is, this is how you know it's time for an Apple car. And I stick by that. You know, when everybody is screaming loudly that it'll never work, that's a market ripe for disruption.
Yep.
I'll play a brief devil's advocate, though. People said that about the TV market, too. And in that case, Apple actually apparently decided that they were right, because Apple did not bring a TV to market.
Well, I will quibble with you on that. It may be that Apple sees televisions as a market ripe to disrupt, but has not figured out yet how to successfully disrupt that market.
Well, but so we remember the story we had a few months ago. It's another. I'm 100% convinced that it was a controlled leak, that Apple killed the television set project so it would have been like a year and a half ago by now. And I mean, that they were actively looking at ways to enter the television set market and then canceled those plans. So I think that we're done with an Apple TV set.
Oh, I think we're done with an Apple TV set as well. I think there'd have to be some radical change for Apple to decide to get back into the television game.
And this car business is what's going to consume Apple for the next several years.
I agree. And the fact that Apple was actually seriously at one point looking at making a television, I am a little surprised, because I've always been in the camp of Apple is not going to make a television.
You were in that camp. You were in that camp, but I was in the camp that Apple was looking at it, and that I thought that Apple would do it. I definitely thought Apple would do it, and I was wrong. But it did turn out that Apple was actively working on it.
Yeah, and I figured they were messing around with ideas, because, of course, they mess around with all kinds of ideas. But it never got to a point where they thought, yeah, let's seriously look at whether or not we can bring something to market.
I think they were serious about it, man.
Well, with the leak that has come out, yeah, it looks like they were serious about it, which surprises me.
All right, but there you go.
Fair enough. But in the end, I'm still right, because no television. Boom.
I'm going to have to. I give you so much crap about all the times you're wrong about a product. You know, but you're always saying, no, I don't think Apple's going to do it. And then Apple does it. In this particular case, you were dead on right.
I'll take it as I can get it.
Watch OS 2.
Yeah. How about that? Hey, how did your update experience go?
Mine was smooth. Mine was perfect.
That's awesome.
It took a while.
I am so glad that I now know a person where the update process went smoothly. Yeah, taking a while doesn't surprise me, because we all tried to download WatchOS 2 at the same time.
Oh, no. You know what? John wrote something about that in his excellent piece today about WatchOS 2. Not enough people bought an Apple Watch for Apple to have a capacity issue.
Okay, then in that case, Apple seriously screwed up that part, because then there was no reason for us to have to go through ridiculously long download times for as small as the update was.
Yeah, that actually must have been a technical. I don't think it was a capacity issue. It was a technical, like there was some issue on Apple's side or on the server side.
Yeah. All right. I don't think
it was a capacity issue. I mean, look how much smoother iOS 9 worked. I mean, 50% of people have already adopted that. I mean, the number of downloads for iOS 9 were huge. And the number of downloads for watchOS 2, by definition, were not huge, because Apple has, to our knowledge, sold only a few million of these things at best.
Right. All right. Well, then the place where I was going to cut them some slack, I really shouldn't have.
No, not at all. Not even a little bit.
Yeah. And then the rest of the process was just, I think, horrible. Just constant failures. I had a problem where the update got stuck in the verification process.
Well, and you know, the thing that was different for me was that I coincidentally rebooted my iPhone, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours before the update was released.
And that may very well have played into why you had success so easily. I've heard a lot of people say that a reboot made the process go smoothly. I didn't have that. And I had a lot of trouble. It didn't take me 5 hours like it took John, but still, from the time I started to the time I had an Apple Watch running watchOS 2, it was 2 hours. And when it was done, the process was grueling enough, I wasn't excited anymore. It's like, oh man, I'm glad that's over with.
Right.
Which is kind of sad, because I wanted to go into the whole experience really excited.
I like time travel.
I like time travel. Hey, I just totally have to do a little happy dance. Mm-hmm. I just got a text message that popped up on my Apple Watch from AT&T letting me know that my iPhone 6S is on the way, which I knew. I got an email this morning with a tracking number, but still, just got a text message. iPhone 6S is on the way.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
I have not gotten a similar text, but I ordered. Did you order directly from AT&T?
Yes, I did.
I ordered from Apple.
Yeah, I had a weird problem where on Apple's site, it was not recognizing my ability to use a Next plan. So I hopped over to AT&T and just did it there. So this is the first time I bought an iPhone from AT&T.
I see.
That makes Anyhow, sense. You were talking about an iOS 9 feature that you were liking, and I totally talked over you because in that moment, I am sorry, I did not care what you were saying.
Fair enough. But I was talking about the watchOS 2 time travel feature.
Oh, right. Okay. See, that shows you how closely I was listening to what you said.
So if you're looking at if you have the watch face up and you just start spinning the digital crown.
Forward or backward in time.
You go forward or backward in time. And so, like, for instance, for me, I've got a weather complication. So it is a way to look and see what the weather is going to be like without pulling up a weather app.
Which weather complication are you using?
Actually, I'm just using Apple's right now.
Interesting. Okay. I switched from Apple's weather complication to Dark Sky's weather complication. And I am much happier because now I'm getting weather information that's far more accurate for where I currently am. Whereas Weather App would give me generalized...
Yeah, probably local nearest airport, which is worthless in Boulder.
Totally worthless in Boulder, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to actually try the Dark Skies one.
I'm really pleased with it. And I loved how yesterday evening when I went out for a walk and I looked at my watch at one point, there was a little umbrella where the temperature complication would be. To let me know, and it said soon right beside it. So I knew that I didn't have much longer to finish my walk before I was going to get wet.
Ah.
I loved that.
I also like, is the chronometer watch face new?
Hold on, let me look.
Well, how would you know if you don't know?
Well, because I'll recognize it. The chronograph?
Yeah.
No, that's not new.
Okay. Well, I just started. I like it. Yeah, I'm still poking around at what, you know, I think the thing about watchOS 2 is really going to be the native apps. And I don't think we've had enough time for those to percolate through the system yet to have a tremendous effect on the overall Apple Watch experience. So really, you know, it feels faster being able to have complications from third party. App developers, you know, it's a good thing. but really it's going to be the native apps that, I think end up making watchOS 2 be better than watchOS 1.x.
Yes, and I am really looking forward to native apps. I have Dark Sky installed, and I'm happy with it. I have OmniFocus installed, and I need to go back and see why I'm having a problem. But for some reason, it keeps crashing on my Apple Watch.
Oh,
Yeah. But I bet there's an easy fix for it, and I will find out what it is.
Fair enough. All right, let's move on to Proactive. Actually, let's move on to MacObserver.com/Apple Store.
Oh, you know why I love that place? I love it because when people go there, they get affiliate links into different online tech gear stores. And when they buy stuff there, we get a little money here. And that goes to help us make sure that we have articles online, we have servers running, and we have podcasts happening, and that we're all here with you guys.
Yeah, especially with the content blockers being native in iOS 9 now.
Mm-hmm.
It's things like this that help support what we do and make it possible for us to do it. So if you like this podcast, you can directly support us by going to MacObserver.com/Apple Store and then clicking on the Apple Store link and shopping when you buy stuff from Apple.
Now, if you're like, I don't need anything from Apple today, but hey, I need to buy like a new cat scratcher and laundry soap and a television, that means you're going to Amazon. And there will be an Amazon affiliate link on that same page.
That's true. And you could also go to MacObserver.com/Amazon.
That's true.
Because that exists too. But the whole point here is that this is an easy way for you to support the companies that support us through affiliate programs.
And they're companies you're buying stuff from anyhow.
Yeah, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. That's the thing.
It's really cool.
Yeah, it's you know, we're pointing you to them, and they will give us a little something for doing so.
Yeah. So thank you in advance for using those links, yeah, because you guys rock.
All right, let's move on to Proactive now.
All right. So what is your favorite thing or your most annoying thing with Proactive?
It's not very useful yet.
I'm hoping that changes. And I agree with you, it's not that useful yet. And I'm wondering if part of that is because my iPhone, or in your case, your iPhone, our iPhones are still having to learn about us.
Well, you know, there's... all right, Proactive is Apple's response to Google Now. It is our iPhones giving us information before we ask for it. And this is a good thing. We talked a lot about Google Now. We've said that it's a very competitive advantage for... Android as a whole, for Google, and that it's like it's a way for Google Now is Google finally giving us something back after making so much money from us.
Yes, and I'm glad Google is doing something this cool to give back, even though it is kind of creepy that they have that much data about us.
Right, but the interesting thing is that Google's business model of pillaging our lives for profit gives the company, it gives Google Now an advantage when it comes to machine learning, when it comes to predictive technologies, when it comes to predicting the things that we need to know. It gives Google a huge advantage over Apple, a company committed to privacy and to not pillaging our lives for profit.
Yeah, that's a good point. So in comparison, what we're getting from Proactive in iOS 9 feels a little anemic compared to what Google Now offers.
It does. It's a lot anemic. And it's not, I mean, like, let's take one of my favorite examples, a buddy of mine who's an Android user. He searched for a band on Google. Did a Google search for a band. 6 months later, that band is coming into town, and Google Now says, hey, this band is going to be coming into town and is going to be playing on this date.
Which is really cool.
It is extremely cool and very, very useful. I mean, of course, you actually have to care about music in this particular case, but there are other things like that that Google Now can do. And for those who commute, both Proactive and Google Now will tell you what traffic is going to be like at a certain time. You know, if you normally, you know, like if you normally go home at work at you know 5:30 p.m., both of these services will actually kick up a traffic alert for you, just to let you know what traffic is going to be like. But I think that there's so much, Google knows so much more about us than Apple, that predicting what we want to know is easier for Google than it is for Apple.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple not only knows less about us, Apple is actually committed to having most of Proactive stay local to our phone.
So that all that information that is being used to help figure out what we want before we want it is private.
Yeah, and that of course is what it's one of the things that we like about you and I both like about Apple products is that they do protect our privacy. But it's this weird trade-off when it comes to something like Proactive and predictive learning.
Yeah, it is, because it would be nice to have Siri's Proactive feature giving me more than it does today.
Yeah, like right now. So, you know, I work out of the house, so I don't commute a lot, and I don't necessarily have a regular schedule for where I go to places. So, you know, that really, Proactive hasn't had much help for me there. But right now I'm looking at the four most recent apps that I've used. I'm looking at four people that I've recently contacted. I'm looking at some searches, restaurants, coffee, shopping, and gas, gas would be because when I took my road trip in August, I would search for gas stations, but that's not actually anything I need local. See, that's not useful.
No, I totally get that.
I mean, I understand why I'm being shown that information, but it's actually devoid of any context, right? The information is being shown to me, in a way that has no relationship to my actual life. So it's no good.
All right. Now, one thing that I have been pleasantly surprised by is that Siri and Proactive have already figured out when I'm likely to be using an app on my iPhone.
Mm.
Yeah. So if I wake up my iPhone around 5 o'clock at night,
mm-hmm.
on the lock screen in the lower left-hand corner, I'm going to see the Tweetbot icon.
See, that's useful. That's good. That's good. Yeah.
And what's really interesting about that is that when I first saw it, I'm like, huh, my Mac is asleep and I'm not using Twitter anywhere, so why am I getting a handoff for Tweetbot? And then I realized that I wasn't. Siri has learned that's about the time of day that I'm going to be consistently doing a Twitter check. And it's one of those things that I didn't realize that's what I was doing until after Siri pointed it out by saying, hey, here's the app you're probably going to use. Right. And Siri was right. That's the app that I was going to use. So that's cool.
That is cool.
I don't use my iPhone for navigation that much. Not because I have an alternate GPS system I'm using, but because I know where I'm going most of the time. And around Boulder, I can walk so many places and I know where they are. I don't need to use navigation. So Siri hasn't been able to learn my other patterns to be able to offer up times when I should leave to go places. Siri has no idea.
Right. Which that actually shouldn't depend on using Apple Maps for navigation, because Apple, our devices know where we are. But this again is one of those things where Apple isn't tracking that stuff. and Apple isn't tracking it to protect our privacy. But it turns out that if this is something that Apple was tracking, it could actually use that to our advantage.
Yes.
And yeah. it's a weird balancing act for Apple to go in. But I think that Apple is always going to be at a disadvantage to Android on this, because Apple doesn't pillage our lives and Android does. Google does, actually.
Yeah, I think you're right. Which now makes me sad to realize, but not too sad because at least I still have my privacy, but sad to realize that when I walk to Starbucks every day to get my drink, I'm pretty consistent about when I go there.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be nice if Siri had a way to, through Proactive, to know what the traffic was going to be like, what the weather is going to be like, and let me know shortly before I would normally head out, hey, take an umbrella with you to Starbucks today.
Yeah. And I imagine that stuff will come. And keep in mind that, first of all, because all this stuff is local, it's still very, very new. By the way, there's one other thing that I see in Proactive, and that's like news stories that that Apple thinks I may be interested in reading. But this is still way early. iOS 9's only been out for a few days. There is a lot about big data that goes into machine learning. And Apple is right now learning all sorts of things on how to make Proactive more useful. And even what they've already done will take time to learn more about us as we use our devices. So, you know, we're commenting on this in the early stages, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's true. Very early stages. So, yeah, I'm assuming that Proactive is going to become more useful over time.
Yes.
And I'm looking forward to that, because it's no secret that I am still pining away for the Knowledge Navigator.
That's true. It is true. All right, we're over an hour.
We are. That means I should wrap us up.
Yeah.
And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. And hey, thanks for listening.
You can follow me on Twitter at TMOBrian. That's Brian with a Y. And Jeff is?
I'm Jay Gamut. I could have told you that earlier, but totally forgot.
You could have. It's okay. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for TMO. And that's all for this week.
And hey, stay subscribed.
We will see you online at the Mac Observer.